dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of my favorite guests is a career intelligence professional. He happens to be my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, its president and CEO, Fred Flights. But before he assumed those responsibilities, he was involved for some 20 years as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, looking very closely, arguably better than just about anybody, at the weapons of mass destruction programs and, for that matter, the ambitions of countries like Iran. He went on to become a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee, also chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton, first as Undersecretary of State and then as the National Security Advisor to the president, a role that I am delighted to say he is performing brilliantly today. Fred Flights, let's talk a little bit about Iran today, as a matter of fact. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
So you've recently published, I believe just yesterday, a piece entitled "Trump Knows His Iran Strategy is Working. Now the ball is in Tehran's court." That is not a universally shared view, I think it's safe to say. Tell us a little bit about the thinking that you're responding to, namely that, well, this whole problem with Iran is the result of the president's Iran strategy, pulling out of the JCPOA, as it's called, the Iran-Obama bomb deal, the title of one of your terrific books. Why isn't that so? And why is the ball now really in Tehran's court?
Well, if you listen to the mainstream media, the president has caused some kind of a problem and he has to find a way to get out of it. And that's not the case at all. What we have here is that President Trump backed out of the extremely flawed nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions because we know that the fruits of this deal was providing revenue to Iran and it was spending on terrorism, meddling in Middle East states, sending troops into Syria, backing the Houthi rebels, backing terrorist groups, including Hezbollah in Lebanon. We know Hezbollah is starving for funds right now because of the president's strategy. This strategy is working. It was a big success, and Iran tried to respond with violence by trying to mine ships in the Persian Gulf. Actually, it mined ships on two separate occasions, last month and this month, firing down an unarmed drone, thinking that they could use this violence to force us to come to the negotiating table and give them concessions to weaken sanctions. Well, that's just not going to work, Frank. If the Iranians want to lower sanctions and lower tensions, they have to come to the table and make significant concessions. The president's in a good position. He doesn't have to offer anything.
There are, though, these calls that we need to get into negotiations with the Iranians. Specifically, we need to begin to resume retooling of the Iran deal. The president seems to be open to negotiations, and yet I think taking a very hard line with respect to this use of force by the Iranians. He chose not to respond in kind to the drone attack, of course, but there have been evidently cyber attacks against the Iranian military. Where do you see that standing at the moment, Fred? Is the president prepared to use military force, and should he at the moment do so?
Well, this was a president elected to get the U.S. out of wars, not into new wars. And I think he's been struggling to reconcile that with his understanding that he may have to use military force against Iran, but he's trying not to. And I think his decision to back off down in the Sana'a drone last week was the right decision because he would have killed 100 or 200 people in retaliation for the downing of a flying robot. And he thought that wasn't justified. I think that was the right call. What we're seeing right now, people arguing that, you know, we have to give in to Iran because of its threats of violence. Look, we don't stay in agreements because the other party threatens to attack us or launch terrorist attacks if we withdraw. That's a reason not to be in such an agreement. And frankly, giving in to such threats would be giving in to blackmail. And that's why the president upped the ante this week by putting more sanctions on Iran, including Iranian leaders, to basically say, it's not going to work. We're not going to give in to threats of violence and blackmail.
Fred, I did want to take a few minutes, and we only have a few minutes, unfortunately, to ask you to sort of truth squad some of the nostrums about where the Iranian nuclear weapons program is at the moment that are being pushed forward by people like Joseph Cirincione of the Plowshares Project, which was a big champion of, in fact, arguably an enabler of the Iranian deal that was, I think, one of the most odious and ill-conceived of any in the world. The president seems to think so, too. Joe holds forth myriad outlets, including Twitter, that the deal, you know, essentially represented the end of the Iranian nuclear weapons program, or formalized that, and kept them at least a year away from being able to restart it with a bomb. Fred, based on what we know about Iran, what we know about their deal, their performance under this deal, where's the truth lie?
First of all, there's substantial information of Iranian cheating, not allowing inspections of military sites, never declaring their prior nuclear weapons-related activities, which was crucial to inspecting and investigating the nuclear program. Cirincione won't talk about that. And the second point is Iran was allowed to continue to enrich uranium with over 5,000 centrifuges and develop advanced centrifuge machines, which was allowing it to perfect its capability to make nuclear weapons fuel. And I talked to Joe Lieberman about this. There should never have been a nuclear agreement that allowed Iran to continue to enrich. The reason it can threaten to enrich more now is because it never stopped enriching. And that was an unacceptable concession to the Iranians. And it reflected, I believe, the understanding by Obama that we can't stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And maybe an Iranian nuclear weapon isn't a problem. There's a lot of liberals who've said that. So let's just sign this agreement. We'll kick the ball down the road, and you know we'll let the next president deal with this problem.
That would be a serious mistake, obviously, and I think the president knows that this is on his watch and is going to have to come to grips with it. And I am very appreciative, Fred, both of your clarity on this subject, and I think that of Ambassador Bolton, who it seems is being subjected to a relentless campaign of personal destruction under this president. And let me just say, you have a close personal relationship with him, having worked with him for many years. I somewhat less so, but I'm a huge admirer of John Bolton. And I think it would be the height of folly and a great boon to our enemies and to the great detriment of our own country were he no longer to be serving in the current role he has of National Security Advisor to the President. Any thoughts?
I think he's an incredible man, a great strategist. He's extremely loyal to the President. And I think it is to the benefit of the President to have such a knowledgeable member of his staff who puts the fear of God in our enemies. And if he has to put forward a tough strategy, sending Bolton to meet with the officials of other countries to lay down the law, I can't see a better way of carrying out our foreign policy.
Amen. Fred Flights, thank you for your very considerable and ongoing contributions to our foreign policy as president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. I always look forward to our visits here each week, and we'll do so again next. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Keep up the great work. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we are delighted to be able to do, to pick the brains of a man of uncommon sagacity. He is Kevin Freeman, a chartered financial analyst by training, but a man who has, over the years, developed a real expertise on matters involving economic warfare. This is the subject of two terrific books he's written, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and the focus of a marvelous program that he has at Blaze TV. And if you're not on Blaze TV as a subscriber, you need to become one. And you can do that through economicwarroom.com. Kevin Freeman, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, speaking of economic warfare, let's talk about some interesting efforts that are being made now by Ellen Lord, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, with respect to trying to promote something that you've been all about for quite some time, notably in the form of your National Security Investment Consultants Institute, namely patriotic investors, and some steps that the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, is taking that may seem to be empowering such things.
Well, Ellen Lord's doing a great thing in seeking out patriotic capital. The reality of it is most of the future of warfighting is tied directly to economic issues, whether or not you have the funding to develop and create new technologies and so forth. And our adversaries, China in particular, has found a way to weaponize all of the companies operating in China to one degree or another by law. They have to function at the behest of the People's Republic of China, which means that ultimately they could be tapped for any military purpose if that's the goal and the purpose of the Communist Party there. And Ellen has acknowledged that and realizes that our capital system is not geared for that purpose. In fact, companies operating in the United States seek to maximize profits, not seek to please the government. And as a result, they'll sell wherever and to whomever unless we put a restriction. She's taking the next step, the proactive step, and saying we ought to find a way to take capital from American citizens, patriotic capital, and allow it not only to make a good profit, but also to do things that are beneficial to our national security. So that's a big step forward. And when you combine that with the SEC proposal, which it's just a proposal at this point, but that would allow ordinary citizens to invest in private equity deals as long as they had an advisor working along with them. You give ordinary Americans the opportunity to do something, you know, more than just buy a war bond as we did in World War II, but actually to make an investment in technology that might benefit our national security and get a return from it. It's a great combination if we can put those two together.
And Kevin, what kinds of information is available to facilitate such investment? Is that something that you really need trained advisors to sort for you, or is there some basis upon which the individual investor, the ordinary investor, as you say, might be able to do that themselves?
Well, I think that's the genius of the SEC proposal. The problem with opening up for an average person the idea that you could invest in a big, a new idea without them having someone sit beside them and say, here are the risks, here are the reward potential, here's where it fits your portfolio. I think that would be very difficult. I mean, it's one thing for a billionaire to throw aside $1 million and say, well, let's try that out. If they lost it, it wouldn't impact their lives. But I think an average investor, someone like I work with all the time, they really do need a trusted advisor sitting next to them. And that's why we've created part of the reason we created the NSIC Institute is to help train advisors to work with ordinary Americans to weaponize their money to make solid investments that fit what their needs, wants, desires, and capabilities are, but also to make certain that those investments are protecting and defending America's security.
And Kevin Freeman, I'm a big fan, as you know, of this group, NSIC, as you call it, Institute. What is the opportunity there for the individual investor to ensure that their financial advisor is trained in the form and with the kind of, sort of portfolio that you're talking about?
Well, what we're doing now with Economic War Room, in fact, is making sure we're using our platform, our media platform, to get the word out. And so if there is an advisor or an individual who has an advisor that would like to have them trained, if there's someone interested in our training, they can go to economicwarroom.com/advisor and give us their names. And we're going to make certain that they have the ability to get into our training course and learn more about what it means to be a national security investment consultant trained advisor.
Fantastic. Well, this is huge. And I'm hoping that Ellen Lord will take note of this and full advantage of it as well. Kevin, let me turn to a different topic. We have this week been learning more about what Google is up to. It's not strictly speaking economic warfare, I guess, but it certainly is information warfare, and it seems as though it's being employed by this tech giant against President Trump and the prospect of his reelection. Not exactly what one thinks of in terms of a neutral platform that has a lot of protections under U.S. law from suits and other kinds of discovery about what they're up to. Give us a flavor of what James O'Keefe's Project Veritas has turned up and what its implications might be as you see it.
Well, James O'Keefe does a terrific job of going undercover, behind the scenes, and really talking to the movers and shakers in various businesses. He's done this with Planned Parenthood, and recently he's done it with Google. And he's captured on film where Google executives are very blatant in their disregard for really half the American population, what they think. Not only is it against President Trump's potential campaign, but they've also done tremendous harm to Dennis Prager's PragerU, which is very conservative. And it was just released this morning that I saw where the insider Google was calling PragerU and Ben Shapiro and a lot of, you know, wonderful people, calling them Nazis. The goal is literally to deny information to half the population so that Google's social views or political views could be basically enforced on the rest of the world. This is not something that you should have from a trusted information platform like Google claims to be.
Yeah. There's a professor by the name of Dr. Robert Epstein, as you know, I think, Kevin, who has done a lot of research before this latest set of revelations from Project Veritas about Google's use of its algorithms and other techniques to manipulate information, in addition to, you know, suppressing some content that it doesn't seem to agree with politically, namely conservative content, but also, you know, how it presents in such information as it does have on its page. Just the ranking, for example, on a Google search that has, according to Dr. Epstein, a profound effect on the likelihood people will even see the content, let alone take it aboard, and other means of trying to kind of manipulate the user. This is a frightening prospect, and unfortunately, I suspect we're still very much at the tip of the iceberg. What would you recommend Congress do about this? There's some talk about regulating the Googles and the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the like, but I'm personally persuaded that, as critics of that idea have said, it would just actually wind up enshrining the existing platforms, even if it, you know, puts some restrictions on them, but essentially winds up keeping out competitors. Your thoughts, Kevin?
Well, one proposal, and Louis Gohmert was the first who shared it with me, is that if you're in the social media business or if you're in the information business like Google, and you are completely neutral in your providing responses, somebody queries for information and you provide completely neutral responses so that they can find what they want and you haven't used an algorithm to try and manipulate in any way, then you're exempt from lawsuit. But if you are using some ability to control what people see, then you are not exempt from lawsuit. And what that would mean would be if you're controlling the type of information people see and somebody is harmed by it in some way, you can be sued for that. Right now, Google is exempt. Right now, Facebook is exempt because they're claiming, well, we're just a free speech platform and people can find what they're looking for and so forth. It's a town hall. It's like using the telephone. You know, you can't blame someone, blame the telephone company if two people conspire over the phone and do something illegal, you can't sue the telephone company. But if Google is actively controlling the search results, they should be subject to lawsuit. Then the free market would solve that problem because they'll either get hammered by all of these lawsuits or they'll decide that they want to give a true free market response and give the information fairly. I think that may be the better solution.
Well, I'm kind of partial to the idea of breaking them up myself, but that may be a half step. As long as it's up to somebody else, not the individual that is being wrong, to establish that they fall into the category of something that is not an impartial platform, but in fact something that is more like an edited publication and therefore subject to suits under the U.S. Code. Hey, very quickly, Kevin, on Economic War Room, you recently interviewed a mutual friend of ours, Kelly Shackelford, about the Bladensburg Cross decision of the Supreme Court. Quickly, tell us how that came out and its implications.
Sure. Well, the Peace Cross is in Maryland. It was on private land. The government encroached and eventually took over the land and said, but we'll keep the Peace Cross in place. Someone saw it, claimed they were offended, objected. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. One judge suggested, well, you just cut the arms off the cross. That will solve the problem, which is ludicrous. But this court ruled properly. The court ruled that this was not the establishment of religion, that the Lemon Clause, the Lemon Test that had been in place for 50 years was wrong-headed, and as a result, the Peace Cross gets to stand.
Kevin, thank you for that update, as well as the incredibly important work you're doing at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Come back to us again next week, if you would, sir.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say every week that we have the chance to visit with Dinah West, who I consider to be one of the great sages of our time on a whole host of issues, but particularly the connection between our history, our present, and our future, which she chronicles with brilliance, notably in her book, American Betrayal, and its kind of follow-on, The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Check out also Dinah's first book, The Death of the Grown-Up. Dinah West, it's so good to talk with you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back.
Well, I do want to say you have been doggedly calling attention through your various platforms, which include, of course, it's dinahwest.net and The Daily Caller and elsewhere. One of the critical pieces of this whole anti-Trump conspiracy, as you call it, namely who got inside the Democratic Committee's, National Committee's servers for the purpose of exposing some of the information there that shed light on what Hillary Clinton was doing to screw Bernie Sanders in the primaries of the 2016 election. Give us an update on what seems to be a growing body of information about who was involved and who doesn't actually have much of a basis for saying it was the Russians, namely the FBI.
Yes. Well, it's a growing body of information, but it's also a static body of information in that it has been evident for years now that we are living a lie every time we say the Russians hacked the 2016 election. It goes back to this original sin, supposedly, of the Russians attacking the DNC server and extracting the embarrassing emails that, as you say, set forth this Democratic inter-party scandal whereby Hillary Clinton was being enabled, protected, advanced by the DNC to the detriment of her chief rival, Bernie Sanders, and other embarrassing and corrupt revelations about these people that they preferred to keep hidden. The Democrats essentially pivoted at the moment of this revelation by Julian Assange's WikiLeaks, going back to July 2016, and began blaming the Russians for this hit on their server. Now, they were already prepared for this, in my view, having already laid the groundwork for this Russia story in June of 2016, where we got this first announcement in Jeff Bezos' Washington Post that the Russians had attacked the DNC, everything was fine now, they had employed not the FBI on this foreign hostile hit on our political system, they had employed a DNC contractor to do all the forensic investigation and indeed replace their computer system, interesting point, a group called CrowdStrike, a very checkered group, I would say, also co-founded by a Robert Mueller protege by the name of Sean Henry. The tangle here is so dense, it's almost crazy. But the basic point that people need to understand is the FBI or any other American government security agents or any independent group, the FBI never examined the DNC server. The entire basis for this Trump-Russia conspiracy that's been foisted upon us is essentially keyed onto this attack of the election.
Diana, what I've been given to understand is, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, because it seems too preposterous to be true, but the FBI not only didn't have access to the servers in the DNC, but it didn't even have access to the full report of the DNC contractor with ties to Russia, of all things, that was given the ability to actually do forensics, we're told, on the DNC servers. In other words, the FBI got a redacted version of the report, so they're not only taking the word of a third party, but they're taking some of the words of the third party, in other words.
Well, it's as if a bank is robbed, the bank president calls up his own people to come in and determine who did it, and then calls in the police and say, we've got your culprit. The whole thing is so preposterous that the fact that it's being taken seriously for years now and has become ingrained and entrenched in our historical record is one of the many scandals of this entire period. It is a lie that we are forced to believe, and so many lies cascade from it because of this faulty foundation. We do not have proof that the Russians attacked the DNC. Had they done this, the NSA would have those paths, those internet paths, tracked. This is just the way the system works. And yet this, too, is sort of conveniently forgotten. We have the other opposing theory, which does offer forensic evidence for anyone to examine, by a group of retired intelligence professionals, namely the most prominent among them being William Binney, a former NSA tech director who actually created many of the data collection programs that are still in use today. And indeed, because they're so unconstitutional, so many of them, he actually left and became a whistleblower on the whole project. His group, VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, they've conducted a series of experiments trying to prove the theory of what happened, trying to understand and present evidence of what did happen. And they've concluded that it could not be a hack from across the internet. Their best solution is that it was somebody who downloaded, because of the speeds of these downloads, that it was someone who downloaded information to a memory stick or CD-ROM and walked out with it. In other words, it was not a foreign attack. And yet we've seen an inside job, and yet we've seen Robert Mueller, for example, put out an indictment of Russian intelligence officers for this crime, based on no independent investigation, based on CrowdStrike.
Based on part of CrowdStrike. I keep coming back to this. It's not even the full document that lays this out. Diana, this is such important work that you really have been doggedly spearheading, as I say. And I just want to both thank you for it and hope that as a result in part of your work and that has flowed from it, that when Robert Mueller is up before the House next month, there will not only be more of this nonsense from him, but more serious cross-examination by, well, Republicans would presume, but I would like to think even some conscientious Democrats, if there is such a thing anymore, that exposes what on earth was actually taking place inside the DNC. And the lack of evidence to make this, as you say, foundational claim as to what was the evidence of collusion between the Trump team and the Russians. Then let me switch gears slightly, because there's one other topic that I really want to cover. In your splendid portfolio, you have recently written a piece entitled FDR's capacious pink mantle. And I wondered if you would just walk us through the relevance of what you so extraordinarily well uncovered in American Betrayal about what FDR was up to and its legacy in our own time, notably among those so-called socialists that are now much in evidence in the Democratic presidential contender ranks.
Yes, well, it's a very big topic. The point here is, again, another illustration on a very large scale of how untruth, how falsehoods, how lies become inculcated through repetition and through emotion and through just longevity. There is this sense that FDR is a conservative icon as well as a liberal icon. And we saw this evidenced in a piece recently at Breitbart by James Pinkerton, who was essentially disputing the notion that Bernie Sanders had any right to claim the legacy or being the standard bearer of FDR, which is something Sanders is doing in his presidential run this time around. He's hitting the FDR story very hard. And this is sort of a, I think, an emotional response to so much false history, so much court history, as our dear friend M. Stanton Evans used to say, whereby the lies of the past are become the truth of today, just as we saw with the DNC server. So cutting to the chase just on FDR, he socialized the American economy in his response to the Depression in the 1930s, and he essentially created the deep state. It was created under his auspices also in the 1930s and 40s through the just sluice gate opening to communists, Soviet agents, pro-communists, fellow travelers, dupes, that took place after he normalized relations with the completely abnormal Bolshevik regime. And this would have been in 1933, November 16th, 1933. He essentially radicalized our government, both domestically and in foreign policy, to a point of being unrecognizable from the republic it had been. And it is just the notion of his capacious pink mantle is just simply that very thing. We are all children of this newfound socialist democratic creation that really gets its major boost under FDR. And if conservatives are upset about that, they really need to reexamine the record and what they really believe about freedom and individualism versus collectivism and state planning, central planning, economic planning. These are all legacies of FDR, and we see in the entire Democratic field an open affinity for that. But much of those ideas have subverted the so-called conservative side as well.
Diana, come back to us again next week if you would. In the meantime, thank you for what you do to inform us and so many others through your writings, among other places, at dianawest.net. Keep it up.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by the great David Goldman. You perhaps know him better by his nom de plume, Spengler, where he writes for the Asia Times brilliant commentary each week. He is also the author of the terrific book, How Civilizations Die, and a new novel, The Quantum Supremacy, available at Amazon and also, I believe, in a serial form at Asia Times. David, it's good to have you back. There's so much to talk about.
I'm always honored, Frank. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Let me ask you first and foremost to talk a little bit about the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Xi Jinping, I think of him as the dictator for life of communist China. There seem to be some efforts being made by the administration to improve the climate, shall we say, for those talks. What's involved in that?
The big news on the markets this morning is that some American tech companies, like Micron, for example, have resumed shipments of chips and other components to Huawei, which fell under an American ban a few weeks ago. The legal technicality is that some of these components have a very low American content, therefore are exempt. But this wouldn't happen unless there were a political decision to allow it to happen. So the most likely interpretation is that President Trump wants to build confidence in advance of the meeting. He's hoping to find a deal with the Chinese. So for those who think a deal is a good thing, it's a good day, and the stock futures are up on the news.
Are you among them?
As my friend Steve Bannon said, I think we need an armistice in this trade war for the simple reason that it's hurting the economy. There's no question that we are in an industrial downturn. Every single piece of data, the purchasing manager indices, the regional Fed indices, all show a declining industrial economy. And we're starting to see some dings to consumer confidence, like from the Conference Board survey yesterday. The prize, in my view, is getting Trump reelected. I'm an always Trumper. I want to be reelected. I'm afraid that if the economy suffers because of the trade war, that might damage his chances of reelection. What I would like to see is a massive American effort to bring semiconductor and telecommunications equipment production back on shore and outcompete the Chinese. You know, I had a talk with a senior Chinese executive. I won't identify him exactly. He said, what we don't understand is, why didn't you get Cisco, one of the great companies, to buy Ericsson, that's one of Huawei's competitors, and create a giant to compete against Huawei? We don't understand why you're not competing against Huawei. That's what I think we ought to do.
Well, I couldn't agree more. In fact, mentioning Steve Bannon, of course, he's been one of the driving forces behind the work we're doing at the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which you are, I'm very pleased to say, a member. We had a meeting in Chicago last Saturday, David, that featured, among others, people who have been, well, part of the electronics industry, the manufacturing industry in this country, who have basically seen their industry devastated by the predatory practices of the Chinese. And they were arguing that what we need in order to bring back this industry onshore and have secure American supply chains for the various purposes that we use electronics these days, we have to have sustained tariffs. That would seem to be at odds with the prescription that we, you know, have an armistice, presumably relieving those sanctions pressure. Is that right?
Well, I think we're going to need a great deal of federal spending on this. Remember, under Reagan, when we spent 1.3% of GDP on federal R&D, mainly through the Defense Department, that's the equivalent of $260 billion a year today. And we basically picked up the whole R&D bill for the electronics industry. The Chinese, like the Japanese and Taiwanese, massively subsidize their industries. We used to subsidize the R&D side and concentrate in innovation. So I think more than tariffs is required. Tariffs can be part of the package, but we're going to have to, I would just go and do exactly what we did when you were helping to run the Defense Department and win the Cold War.
Well, I think you're right. It needs to be part of the package is the point, though. And there are those who argue, of course, as part of coming to terms with the Chinese, we're going to have to throw the tariffs over the side. We'll be following closely what is going to go down this weekend in Japan, and I know you will as well, David Goldman. Let me switch gears. Talk about another subject in which you are expert, and I know following closely, and that is Turkey. There was an election for the mayor of Istanbul that did not go Erdogan's way. Can you put this into a little bit of context for us, David, and what should we draw from this outcome with respect to one of the most dangerous, it would seem to me, men certainly in the Middle East, and that's saying something.
Erdogan is two things. He is a megalomaniac Islamic fundamentalist who wants to establish a new caliphate, but he's also a traditional third world borrow and spend and buy votes kind of politician who got a pretty good ride from running up debt, doing a lot of construction work, expanding the Turkish economy on a very unsound basis. And that's come to an end. Turkey's in a sharp recession. Turkey's credit is in real trouble. The economy's shrinking. So it's natural for the voters to back away from him. There is not a more than 50% majority for a hardline Islamist fundamentalist party. So without the economic side, Erdogan is slipping. That said, he's showing no signs at all of moderation. The fact that he's insisted on buying the Russian S-400 air defense system, which basically makes him a renegade from NATO and will almost certainly stop us from selling the F-35 aircraft, shows that the megalomaniac side won't go away. So I think a number of additional humiliations of Mr. Erdogan are going to be required before that situation sorts itself out. And we should devote some intellectual energy to figuring out what those ought to be.
Boy, I couldn't agree more with that. Especially figuring out what you do about the problem you touched on there a moment ago, David Goldman, which is the fact that there is no mechanism in place for expelling anybody from NATO. And therefore, while we may decline to sell him the F-35, he's still got access to NATO's intelligence and a whole host of other sensitive information and technologies and so on. That country that is, as you helped us describe in a book called Turkey, Ally No More, is at best a very unreliable partner, if not actually playing for the other team.
Well, perhaps that's a job for your Center for Security Policy. Get some international lawyers to propose a mechanism for expelling renegade members.
Well, we'll get on this. We've been thinking about it, but we'll see what we can do to pull it together a team. David, let me ask you about one other matter that is, of course, being brooded in certain circles at the moment, and that is that President Trump is going to succeed where so many others have failed in brokering a peace between Israel and the Palestinians. His son-in-law is in the midst of trying to sell a number of other countries on the idea that there ought to be a big fundraiser for the Palestinians and that that will mollify them into accepting the reality of the state of Israel and coming to terms, making an enduring and secure peace for Israel and the Palestinians. What's your prognosis on this effort of Jared Kushner's and specifically the idea that more money for the Palestinians will do the trick?
Well, first of all, I have the highest regard for President Trump's Middle East negotiating team, not only Jared Kushner, but Ambassador David Friedman and Special Envoy Jason Greenblatt. I think they're excellent people. I believe they feel the United States is obligated as a great power to offer a peace solution. I very much doubt this will get anywhere, given the inherent intransigence of the Palestinians, who don't want a state. They want to continue a subsidized terror non-state regime with all the benefits and no responsibilities. So the only good thing that's likely to come out of the Bahrain conference is to expose the Palestinians for what they are, which is basically a bunch of parasitic gangsters who are not interested in a program that evidently would massively benefit their own people. So the negative outcome itself has a positive consequence, and that's the best we can hope for.
Yeah. And the growing antipathy the Palestinians towards their so-called government is another thing that is almost certainly going to be on display here, too. David, we have to leave it at that. Thank you, my friend, for your time today, as always, and Godspeed in your important work at Asia Times, among others. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with you, the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.